Tonight we're in the 52nd chapter of Isaiah and chapter 53. It seems to me it's been such a short time that I spoke on chapter 53, but I never read the chapter. I never study it. But what it grows more intensely glorious in my mind, studying it afresh today, made me realize even more the glory of our Christ who gave himself for us. I want to look back, however, to the 51st chapter, because really, there is no dividing point between chapter 51 and chapter 52, verses 1 through 12. And I think that the chapter division should have been here at verse 13, for that's where the new thought begins. And really, you don't need a chapter division at 52. Let me look back for just a moment at what we had in chapter 51, dropping down here to verse 17. We have here a very ugly picture, very sordid picture of Zion. And she lay as a woman, a drunken woman, in the stupor of drunkenness. Notice, awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem, that has drunk at the hand of Jehovah the cup of his wrath, that has drunken the bowl of the cup of staggering and drained it. That is, this judgment that's been brought upon her is, and it left her staggering as a drunk woman. In fact, she is, as it were, has fallen. So now then God calls upon her to stand up. He goes on to say, there is none to guide her among all the sons whom she had brought forth. Neither is there any that taketh her by the hand among all the sons that she had brought up. In other words, here she is as a mother, drunken, forsaken of her children, no one to hold her up, no one to lead her. That's a description of Zion, as she will be in a captivity, having gone there as a judgment of God, having drunk the cup of the wrath and the fury of God. Then it goes on there, these two things are befallen thee, who shall bemoan thee, desolation and destruction, and the famine and the sword. Well, we studied that, I concluded last time, dropped down here, verse 22, where he says, Behold, I have taken out of thy hand the cup of staggering, even the bowl of the cup of my wrath. Thou shalt no more drink it again, and I will put it into the hand of them that afflict thee, that have said to thy soul, bow down that we may go over. Now that's from Babylon. And Babylon is not mentioned, I believe it's after chapter 48. I think that's the last time Babylon is named. But Babylon is under consideration here. We carried away the people of Zion into captivity. Now God said, I'm going to take this cup of staggering, the cup of my fury and wrath that I've let you drink of. Now then, I'm going to put it in the hands of Babylon and make Babylon drink it. And Jeremiah dealt with that especially. Now, chapter 52, he's continuing that thought. Awake, awake, put on thy strength, O Zion. Put on thy beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. For henceforth thou shalt no more come into thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Shake thyself from the dust. Arise, sit on thy throne, that is, as a queen. O Jerusalem, loose thyself from the bonds of thy neck, O captive daughter of Zion. Now, here he's calling upon Zion again to awake, awake, put on the beautiful garments of the rightly hers. That is, she's to sit as a queen, for she belongs to God. Jerusalem, Zion, Jerusalem, are used interchangeably there. Put on these beautiful garments and be a holy city. Now, that's in contrast to, it's really a continuing contrast to Babylon. Now, look at Babylon in 47 and verse 1. But we were talking about Babylon here before. For it says, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate. And it goes on to describe, as verse 5, sit thou silent and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, thou shalt no more be called the mistress of kings. And he goes on to discuss Babylon that is going to be cast down. Now, in contrast to that, Zion, Jerusalem Zion, has been cast down. She's been in captivity. She has drunk the cup of the Jehovah's wrath. Now, God's going to raise her up. And he says to Babylon, now you sit down in the dust and on the ground. So Babylon is going to be cast down. Jerusalem is going to be exalted and lifted up. But now here's another point there. For thenceforth there shall no more come into thee the uncircumcised and the unclean. Now, I have a commentary on Isaiah written by one of the brethren down in Abilene University there. He takes a position here that this is talking about Jerusalem after it returned from Babylon. But that's contrary both to history and to the scriptures. Because when they got back, why, they were a very low group for a long time. And then after Alexander's invasion of the land, they were kicked back and forth as a football between Syria and Egypt. Were under the control of others all of that time. And then when you come to the 70 A.D., Jerusalem was completely destroyed by the Romans, cast down completely. So I know you're not talking about that. Not only that, but the Bible tells over and over that Jerusalem is going to ultimately, the nation is going to be destroyed. I use that, we talked about that last time in the 51st chapter, where heaven would pass away as smoke, and the earth would be melted there, and so on. So, if both contrary to scripture and contrary to history, this has no reference whatever to Jerusalem after the return from captivity. Well, if it doesn't, what is it talking about? It's talking about spiritual Zion. Now, awake and put on this righteousness, put on your holy garments, and sit as a queen, that is, as God's people. What he called upon them to do that, and thee shall not come in. Now, look back at Isaiah 35, which we had a few months ago. Look at what he says here, as he describes it there. Now, and he says here that, look at verse 5. Strengthen ye the weak hands and confirm the feeble knees. Say to them that are of a fearful heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God he will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as a hart, and the tongue of the dumb shall sing. For in the wilderness shall waters break out, and streams in the desert. And the glowing sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the habitation of jackals where they lay shall be grass and reeds and rushes. Now notice, and a highway shall be there, and a way. And it shall be, that is, this way shall be for the be called a way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for the redeemed, the wayfaring men, yea, fools, shall not err therein. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast go up thereon. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there, and the ransomed of Jehovah shall return, and come with singing unto Zion, and everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. And who's that talking about? That's talking about the spiritual Zion. You remember Jesus said when John the Baptist sent and asked him, art thou he that cometh to look weep? And I will tell John the thing you did here. How that the blind see, the lame walk, the dumb speak there, the poor have the gospel preached unto them, and so on. Huh? Using these very expressions here, which were used back there symbolically and figuratively of the spiritual condition of the new Zion. So I don't think there's any question. What he's talking there about the messianic period of Zion, and we'll get to that in a few minutes too. All right, so it moves on now then. And O Jerusalem, loose thyself from the bonds of thy neck. That's the bonds of captivity. They were kept in bondage to sin. Jesus said, everyone that committed sin is a bond servant of sin. So they were in bondage to sin when Jesus came to them. For thus saith Jehovah, ye were sold for naught, and you shall be redeemed without money. For thus saith the Lord Jehovah, my people went down at the first into Egypt to sojourn there, and the Assyrian hath oppressed them without cause. Now, God doesn't owe any nation anything. Now, when the Jews went down into Egypt under Joseph, that was at the invitation of Pharaoh. You remember that. Pharaoh told him. Why, he said, go in, send for your parents, your folks, bring them down here. We'll give them the best of the land. So they went down into Egypt by invitation as guests of Egypt, but were made slaves while they were there. So God didn't owe them anything when he took these people out of Egypt. They'd been enslaved unjustly. Now, Assyria, he didn't owe Assyria anything, and Assyria had come in and taken away Israel, although God used them to do it, and also Assyria had threatened at Jerusalem, and God threw 185,000 of them and turned them back. Now here's Babylon. God doesn't owe Babylon a dime. He's not indebted to them. He and they simply came over and carried away these people because it was in their heart to do that. He Habakkuk, the first chapter, verses 5 through 11, gives you a description of the invasion of the Babylonians when they should come, and the character and nature of it. So what God is saying here now, I'll redeem you. I'll redeem you from, I'll save you from Babylon. I brought you out of Egypt. I will bring you out of Babylon. I'll save you from Assyria. I'll bring you out of Babylon, and I'll also deliver you from Satan. That bondage, I don't owe him anything either. But God doesn't owe anybody anything. So if he wants to redeem a people, they belong to him anyway. They're his but creation. I think this is the thing that Isaiah is trying to get people to see. That God is able to do this, and he will do this. You're in Babylon, or will be there, because of your own sins and your own choice. Why are we in bondage to sin today? Choice. Somebody's choice. I get so irritated watching this Pope coming over here and all the millions and billions he's spending because he's coming over and all of that, and people in bondage to him, bowing and scraping. But it's either of their, it's of their own will. Now, it may be that their parents put them in that when they were babies, but they've got a will of them. They can get out if they want to. They're in bondage unto Roman Catholicism because that's their choice. People in bondage to sin because that's their choice. So if we choose to be in bondage, why, we're there as a result of that. So are these people. Well, all right. I think some good lessons in here for us. And God goes on to say here, verse 5, now therefore, what do I hear, saith Jehovah, seeing that my people is taken away for naught? They that rule over them do howl, saith Jehovah. My name continually all the day is blasphemed. I think God says, well, I don't know Assyria in that. Don't know Egypt. I don't know Babylon anything. I don't know Satan anything. So what am I doing sitting here? Let me arrive and redeem my people. Of course, that's accommodative language there of God. That's what God is saying. But his name is continually blasphemed by them. Paul quoted that in Romans, what was it? Second chapter, somewhere along there. And God's name was blasphemed among the Gentiles because of the conduct of the Jews. He moves on. Therefore my people shall know my name. Therefore they shall know it is that day that I, in that day, that I am he that doth speak. Behold, it is I. When he redeems them from Babylon, they'll know that I am God. When he redeems us from sin, we shall know that he is God. May that possible through Christ. We'll come to that in just a moment. Now notice beginning here, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, that publisheth peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth. Now Paul quoted that in Romans 10, chapter 1, verse 15, how beautiful the feet of them that bring the good news. Yes, that means how competent are they, how glorious are those that bring the good news. I don't think I ever read that passage, but I think I've told you this before. So, little old preacher that came over Wilcox when I was just a boy. Little old fella went over that. Boy, the biggest feet I ever saw, a little man. He quoted that scripture, how beautiful the feet of him to bring the good time. I looked down at these feet. I got tickled. My kid will, you know. Finally, I guess I got myself under control. But every time I read this passage, I think about that. Isn't that funny? How you remember those silly things and the things worthwhile you forget. But I do remember the passage. Because I looked down at his feet and got tickled. Well, isn't that? But that's not what he meant. He didn't mean they're literally pretty. He just meant that how beautiful those that bring the good news, glad tidings, publish peace, bring good tidings of good, publish your salvation, all of those things. Seth and his eye, thy God reign. The voice of thy watchmen, they lift up the voice together, do they sing. For they shall see eye to eye, that is, they'll behold it. That expression is found over in Numbers, that only a time it's ever found, and that was translated face to face. Here they see eye to eye, that is, these that are rejoicing and singing, they see together the beauty of their salvation. When Jehovah returns to Zion, break forth into joy, sing together, ye waste places of Jerusalem. For Jehovah hath comforted his people, he hath redeemed Jerusalem. Jehovah hath made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. What does that mean? Rolled at his sleeves, he's gotten the garments out of his way. Ready to go to work and bring back his people now. Not a graphic expression there. For he's ready to bring them back. Or to lay bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. Depart ye, go ye out from thence, touch no unclean thing, go ye out of the midst of her. Cleanse yourselves, you that bear the vessels of Jehovah. Now they would be the priests. Cleanse yourself and prepare yourself to carry out these matters. Now, whereas that would have an immediate application in their return from Babylon, it looks beyond that under the Messianic period. You can just see the Messianic period all the way through this. And it looks to the point where God says, cleanse yourselves, bear the vessels of Jehovah, and holy array. We're his priests. We're all priests today. Now, finally, for ye shall not go out in haste. Now, notice the difference between this and the leaving Egypt. When they left Egypt, God told them to go out in haste. So they had their clothes on, their kneading troughs were all bound up, had everything ready, and so after midnight, when the death angel had passed over, and they were told to go, they went out in haste. Another difference is, when they went out, they were to borrow from the Egyptians and despoil them. But now notice this, for you shall not go out in haste, neither shall you go by flight, for Jehovah will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rearward. In other words, now you go out not in haste, God's going to lead you. God will be behind you to protect you. I don't imagine that they had the cloud of fire by day and a fire by night and pillar of cloud by day. I don't think they had that. No, they didn't. From the reading of Ezra and their return and the fear that they had and all that. So what he means is, I will be your protection. I'll take care of it. All right, so now that's a call to chapter 51 and 52 down to that point. Deals with Zion. 51st chapter, the desolate state of Zion. Desolate condition. As a drunken mother, the children fled and left. Now, but awake, stand up, put on these garments of holiness. Take your throne, be what God intended for you to be as his people. Now, here is the ground on which that will be accomplished. Now, here beginning with verse 12, 13 through 53rd chapter, as great child, I don't remember, I read that a while back, I don't remember what for, and I'm going to study it. And anyhow, I'm going to read it again rather hurriedly tonight, though I've been over it so many times. But then you come back in the 54th chapter, you come back to Zion again. So here, when you close with Zion in verse 12, now in between is the servant of Jehovah, who, by whom they were redeemed. And then we come to 54, and here is the shout now of redeemed, of the exhortation to redeemed Zion. hope we can keep that before us and see it as we go along. Now, the chapter begins with verse 13. 13 to through 15. Now, he's speaking here in the future tense. In 53, 1 through 9, he speaks in the past tense. In verse 10 through 12, he's speaking again in the future tense. I don't know why. I think I do. I think it's because that what God is going to do, he can speak of it as if it were already done. Because of his predetermination, that's what it would be. Remember that Peter said in Acts the 2nd chapter, talks about the foreknowledge of God there. Who by the foreknowledge of God that did these things here? All right, let's read this now.
Behold, my servant shall deal wisely. He shall be exalted and lifted up and shall be very high. Now notice those three things. He'll be exalted, he'll be lifted up, he'll be very high.
Seems to me that you have each one as a step, progressive step in its elevation. Now it's 232, isn't it? Along that somewhere where Peter makes reference to this. All right, wherefore God is highly exalted, and Philip, and God highly exalted him, given him the name in Acts 2:32, where he speaks of having raised him up to sit on David's throne, exalted right to the right hand of God. In that passage. All right, let's note, like as many were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred, more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. That's a parenthetical statement there of what astonished these people, how he looked there as they beheld him. Now let's go back to that. Were astonished at thee, now 15, so shall he sprinkle or startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him, for that which had not been told them shall they see, and that which they had not heard shall they understand. Now, there's a question with biblical scholars as to whether they should be translated sprinkle or startle. Now, let me give you the reason for the two different views. Back under the Old Covenant, blood was sprinkled upon the people. Ashes and water were sprinkled upon the people. There was a sprinkling to cleanse them from defilement. So some think that the word here refers to the cleansing power of the servant, and it will cleanse them. I think the context better fits the word startle. And that's what you have that in the footnote of alternate reading there. Shall startle many there. Now let's look at that. For many were astonished at thee, what it says there. And then come on down. So shall he startle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him. For that which had not been told them shall they see. That is, when he's exalted, lifted up, and what had the, and that which they had not heard shall they understand, which startled them, like would cause them to spring up in amazement after what they see afterward, after the in his exaltation, when he lifted up. So here then, he begins at the bottom here. Nothing about him that would you would look for in looking for a king. But now then you're startled at the fact that he is exalted and lifted up and so many followers, has so many followers. Now, I think that's the idea of it. Now, in the next year, he now goes ahead to talk about the, beginning with verse 1 here, what they behold. Who hath believed our message, says Isaiah, and to whom hath the arm of Jehovah been revealed? Well, now that's quoted in Romans the 10th chapter in verse 16, maybe another passage. Who hath believed our report? All right, now why our? I think it means Isaiah. Then who believed him? Nobody. Who believed Christ? Nobody. Not many. Who believed the apostles? Very few. Who has believed our report? That of Christ, the prophets, and of Christ, and of the apostles. I think that's why he used the word our instead of mine, or his, or who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm, that's the power, of Jehovah been revealed. For he grew up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He has no form nor comeliness, and when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. Now, what does that mean? He grew up out of a dry ground. Well, two things. Israel, when Jesus came, was in its religious and moral state, was very dry. The Pharisees were the primary teachers and leaders, and they're feeding them on the dry husks of traditionalism. Very little of the true message of God there. Then, not only that, but as he grew up out of the root of David, the house of David was in decay. It was fallen. It had been how many years? Over 500 years. Now, 600 years since the seed of David sat upon the throne of David. So here the house of David was in a state of decay, and the house of Israel was in a state of moral and spiritual decay. So he grew up in that kind of an environment, and grew up in that kind of a situation. Right? And so here, there is no beauty that we should behold him. That is, the word beauty refers to the regal trappings. There was no regal trappings about Jesus that we would desire him as a king. Right? He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Right? And acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Now notice, he speaks in the past tense, looking forward to what will happen, as though it had already happened. God was so certain that that's what would happen, that he speaks of it as if it had already happened. And that's exactly, of course, what happened. So there in that particular, those three verses there, we see what happened to him here, and that his grief here, his acquaintance here with grief, one acquainted with grief, and he was. He took our sins upon him. He took our sorrows. He took the grief of man as a result of sin upon himself. He was acquainted with that. Now in the next year, now here he is presented as a vicarious sufferer. What vicarious means, an innocent person suffering for the guilt. And that's so he takes that upon himself. Surely, he has borne our griefs, that is our sickness, our spiritual sicknesses, carried our sorrows, our mental sorrows, our inward sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. That is, smitten of God, that simply means God allowed that to happen to him, which happened to him. Of course, it was the satanic forces, the satanic force working among the Jews that did it. The devil did it, God allowed it. So I used to hear that question. Who put Christ to death? Sin, God, or the devil? Well, sin did in the devil. The devil's operating, God allowed it. That's all God did. He allowed it as a sacrifice. For our sins, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisements of our peace, and that would be the punishment there. So the word chastisement does not always mean punishment. It may mean correction. And I will talk about that one of the days in Hebrews. And if by stripes we are healed, all we like sheep have gone astray. Peter quoted that, you remember? In 1 Peter 2, all we like sheep have gone astray, and it laid on him the iniquity of us all. We have turned everyone to his own way, and Jehovah has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Now, look at that passage there. We've all gone astray. We've turned every man to his own way, and Jehovah laid on him the iniquity of us all. That, to me, is one of the best definitions of iniquity that I know. It's simply for a man to go his way, to substitute his way for God's way. That's what iniquity really is. It's simply an individual's substituting what he wants, the way he wants to act, for the way that God would have him act. That's iniquity. Sin is to miss the mark. That's a word from the archery. As you shoot the arrow here, you miss the target out there, you miss the mark. That's sin. Transgression is to go beyond, to go over. iniquity is deceptive, you away for God's way. No three words. Sin and iniquity and transgression are so often used together in the Old Testament. They're three words. They have three different meanings. So all of them wind up what we call sin. Sin. Miss the mark. Go beyond. Substitute your way of mind for God's way. While you laid on him the iniquity of us all. Now, I look for all we like sheep that have gone astray. Nobody to gather us, no one to bring us in. By his stripes, we are healed. Now here is a total submission of the servant to Jehovah's will. He was oppressed, yet when he was afflicted, he opened not his mouth. As a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and as a sheep that is before its shearers is dumb by oppression, and so he opened not his mouth. I don't know what you've ever done on a sheep ranch, Texas, or here in Arizona, anywhere. But I remember when my dad-in-law killed sheep. I was out there one time, and as he killed his sheep for meat purposes, not a one of them made any noise at all. I said, I don't want that. No one bleeding. That's the point here. That's the idea suggested here. And Dalich, what I think one of the greatest Old Testament commentators, he says that every reference in the New Testament to Jesus as the Lamb of God with reference to our sin is rooted back in this statement. This idea of the Lamb of God here. Now look at it here. He opened his mouth as a lamb that is led to the slaughter, as a sheep that before his shearers is dumb, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, or from oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who among them considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due? I want to look at this matter here. By oppression and judgment he was taken off from it. Or the passage in Acts the 8th chapter there, as he quoted it there. But what did the passage mean? There have been a lot of views, but it seems to me that when you look at the trials of Jesus, Pilate came out three times, according to John 18 and 19, three times that I find no crime in him. Three times. They said, away with him, away with him. So if he found no crime in him, what should he have done with him? Turn him loose. But he reversed that. He said, oh, I'll take him and crucify him. So in his humiliation, his judgment was taken away. It's quoted in Acts. In humiliation, his judgment was taken away. He was taken away from it there. In other words, the judgment was innocent. But the judgment was reversed, and it says, crucify him. And we turned him over to be crucified. That seems to me to be the idea there. I know there are other ideas. That may be good. But it seems to me, or some think, that from this oppression here of the Jews, he was taken away and crucified. But I never didn't like that one too well, but really, the oppression continued until they nailed him to the cross and he was dead. So I think of it as, in his humiliation, his judgment was taken away. The judgment was, he's innocent. Verdict, in other words, innocent. But the judgment was crucified. Very unjust. But now, know his generation, who shall declare? Now, a generation, that doesn't mean the Jewish race. A generation is that particular group of one's own lifetime. The generation would be those that were living at that time. Now, our millennial people try to make generation refer to a race. This generation shall not pass away, law of these things be accomplished. They say that means this race shall not pass away. The word generation is not used in the New Testament one single time as a race, always as a people of that particular period in which you're discussing a thing. Right? Judgment was taken away, and as for his generation, who among them considered that he was cut off out of the land for the living, for the transgression of my people, whom the stroke will do. Now that word that was cut off is a very strong word. It means a violent taking away. For it was a very violent taking away when they took him out and crucified him. All right, he was cut off out of the land for the living, for the transgression of my people. Now, the stroke was really due to God's people. Now, instead of saying he's the one put to death, the Lord looked into their own lives and compassed for him and his life, what he is and what he has done. We're the one that ought to be put to death. But a sinner can never see that, can he? He always seeks to justify himself. All right, now again. And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death. Well, now that was literally for a field, for Joseph Arimathea and that other fellow. Then they came, and Joseph was a wealthy man, asked Pilate for the body, and they buried him in a tomb there that time. And with a wicked and a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, neither was any deceit found in his mouth. Now, ordinarily, the Roman custom was to bury a fellow with his cross, put the two together. The Jews, generally, folks like they just flung out in the dump heap and let the buzzards have them there. Although they put him to death as they did, I think God in his providence was determined that his son would not suffer like that. That kind of ignominy, that he would receive a decent burial. So somehow in his providence, he used Joseph of Arimathea, and what was the other fellow's name? Came to him and asked him for the body. Okay, and they buried him there. Now, this last, and now he returns to the future tense. Yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. He hath put him to grief, but he hath put him, when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, that's future. He shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. Let's look at that. It pleased Jehovah to bruise him. Strange, didn't he? He put it and put him to death. Right? And we shall prolong his days. The pleasure of Jehovah down here shall prosper. Two words there. But what does it mean there? Yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. The word bruise is a harsh word. It means to crush. It's to crush him there. Pleased, it's a consequence. God didn't get any pleasure out of that. He turned his face from it. It pleased him to provide a sacrifice by which man could be redeemed. That was the plan of God. That was the thing that pleased him. But here was a sacrifice by which I can redeem lost mankind, bring them back to myself. This not only shows us the sufferings of Jesus, but it also shows the great magnanimity of the heart of God. How that God was pleased to make this sacrifice to save people from sin. He chose his heart as well as the others. Put him to grief, an offering for sin. Now notice, he put an offering for sin. Now he shall see his seed. What does that mean? That this servant shall see his spiritual offspring. Those that will be his of a spiritual nature. And that, of course, by redeeming them. He shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days. Now, as pointed out here, that he poured out his life, David said. But to prolong his days indicates what? His resurrection. So there you see his death. His death there among the wicked. His resurrection. These things and those that shall follow his seed. Prolong his day, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. The pleasure of what is the pleasure of Jehovah? The redemption of mankind. That's going to prosper where? That'll prosper in his hand. Through his sacrifice and what he does here, through that, men will be redeemed. Great chapter. I see not how any Jew can read that and read it carefully and look at Jesus Christ and not say there he is. He is our Redeemer. But they find others, they say, no, that's not an individual. That is the Jewish race. By the suffering of the Jewish race, while men are redeemed or brought to God, and God revealed through them. Right? Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. Now notice, he shall see of the travail of his soul, that is the travail of the suffering of the soul of Christ, the life that is poured out, and shall be satisfied. That is, here is a sacrifice that satisfies the justice and the righteousness of God and the love of God in saving men. Makes the Lord just. Makes him just. Man's worthy of death, but God allowed his son to die in our stead. So in that, his soul should be satisfied. By the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many. Whose knowledge? The knowledge of the Lord, of the servant. As we come, and Jesus said, no man can come except the Father that sent me drawing. As written in the prophets, they shall all be taught of God. He that heard and has learned cometh unto me. So when he says here, this statement here, by the knowledge of himself shall my righteous servant justify many. Not by his knowledge of himself and who he is, but by the sinner's knowledge of Christ and what God has done in Christ, shall man be redeemed. Be justified, counted righteous. So this is the point there. Justified, and he shall bear their iniquities. Now up here, you had it up here. Let me go back and look now. Verse 5, with his stripes we are healed. Drop down here to about verse 8, for the transgression of my people whom the stroke will be. Drop down here in about the middle of verse 10, an offering for sin, who shall see his seed. Now note this one, a lot of part of verse 11, he has justified many, and he shall bear their iniquities. All of these bring before us here what was accomplished in the sacrifice of Christ. I used to ask myself, why couldn't God have done it some other way? I don't have an answer for that. I think the very nature and character of God, and the nature and character of sin, and the nature and the character of man, are all such that there was no other way by which God could redeem man. That's as far as I'm able to tell you. Beyond that, I don't know. I know that's the only way. I know that's the only way. Because I don't think there could have been another. Now therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death and was numbered with the transgressor. Well, you remember the passage in Luke 11:21-22, when the strong man, fully armed, guarded his own court, his goods are in peace, for when a strong man he cometh upon him, I shall overcome him and take from him the armor wherein he trusted. He divided the spoil. Now in that, the devil is a strong man. Jesus is a stronger than he who comes upon him, overcomes him, and takes away from him that power that he had, and now that he divides the spoil with him. That's suggested also in Hebrews 2 and verse 14, seeing them as the children that shared in flesh and blood, he also in separate like manner partook of the same, that through death he might bring to naught him that had the power of death, that is the devil, and might deliver all them who through fear of death were all alike, time subject to bondage. So those several passages, along with others we can quote from the New Testament, all are in fulfillment of this passage. That here he divides the spoil with the strong here. Alright, so he poured out his soul into, I will divide him a portion with the great. That is, he'll have a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. That doesn't mean the strong man, the devil's the great one. I'm going to elevate him among the great, but he's going to divide the spoil with the strong. That was Satan, and he did that. He did. And that is a conflict. Interesting to go through this chapter and notice all the different things that were accomplished and achieved by Christ's victory over death and the grave. Now notice, brother, and he was numbered with the transgressors. Yes, he was numbered with man, numbered with the sinners. Yet he bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. I think that not only looks to his on the cross, it does, it includes that. When he was numbered here with the two malefactors, two thieves, and then said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. But in Hebrews 7:25, wherefore he ever lived to make intercession for them. So he still lives to make intercession for us as we come unto God through him. And so he bare the sins of many, made intercession for the transgressors. as I looked at television tonight, I don't want to look much at old folk. I don't understand to see him come on there and all the glory they're giving him now all the time. I couldn't help but think as I studied this lesson today, what a contrast between Jesus Christ and the Pope, the so-called vicar of Christ. And why spend these millions of dollars to protect him? All those mafia and all the mob, they're Catholics anyway. They're not going to kill him. None of the rest of them want to waste a bullet on him. So, do you see any sense in it? Some fellow will shoot him, just say, I got charity. Oh, but anyhow, but what I thought of was a contrast. Here's a fellow with all of his fine robes and his golden crown and bowing and scraping and all of that. And here was Jesus going, because this is the vicar of Christ. This is representative of him. I presume he would answer and say that when that Christ is exalted. He pointed that out. First chapter, he was greatly exalted. So I'm his vicar after his exaltation. I bought him a sermon. I don't know how you feel about it. I think the whole news media, what they're doing is an insult to the 150 or 60 non-Catholics in this country. Cram that down our throats every time it's on television. Last week, this week, and get work for the week, so maybe I got no business saying anything about it. I consider it an affront to me as an American citizen and an insult to cram that down my throat every time on television.